I needed to not skate by for once in my life, and they didn't let me.
At the end of the day, if you know that you don't feel good about the job, you gotta be able to leave that behind.
They just kept asking me to come back, and I truly love Milwaukee and Southeast Wisconsin.
It's always great to be at WTMJ.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. On January 31st of 2004, she was left for dead by her abusive ex-husband. Miraculously, she survived, and she's since worked as an advocate for victims, including Wisconsin Safe Act and Marcy's Law. Joining us is Terry Gendusa Nicolai.
Hello there.
Terry, I first met you years ago when you were speaking at TWC luncheon about your experiences. And for people who aren't familiar, I mean, there's been a book written about you. There's been a TV show. And I never really had the opportunity to sit down and talk to you one-on-one about this.
Yeah, there are numerous TV shows. In fact, 2020 and Investigation Discovery, went to Dr. Oz, was on Oprah. I didn't get a car, but when I was on Oprah. And all this to try to raise awareness of domestic violence and give people, mostly women, but people, there are men who are abused as well, opportunities to look and say, how can I prevent getting into a situation like this? How do I get out of a situation like this?
So I guess the thing I'm really wondering is, how did you get into a situation of being married to a guy who was just a monster?
You know, I look back, I'm like, whoa, what was I thinking, right? But, you know, these men don't always come off as total jerks. They can be charming, right? He was an air traffic controller. He had a good job. He went to church. He was active in his church. On the surface, he looked like a good person. It wasn't until you really got into that relationship where you recognize how they are in relationships. Very controlling, very abusive. And, you know, I wasn't brought up in anything like that at all. I had a very good upbringing, a very good family. So I didn't recognize any of those signs. If something happened, I would just think, okay, maybe he's in a bad mood, or maybe I shouldn't have done this, or maybe I should have said that. And you start kind of placing their behavior on yourself.
But weren't there some weird things going on? I mean, he locked you inside the house while he went to work.
Yes, he actually locks installed like from the outside. So you couldn't get out from the inside. And this had happened about a year after we were married. When we were dating, it was, well, you won't have to work. Well, a lot of people might be like, oh, yeah, I don't have to work, right? And I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, so I didn't think anything of it. I thought, great, that's what I want to do. Well, little did I realize it wasn't you don't have to work. It was you can't work. And then it wasn't just work. It was, you know, you can't go to lunch with your sister. You can't go do this with your friends. It's very controlling. They start isolating you from people. And again, it's hard to recognize at first, but then you start seeing a pattern.
But when those locks were put on, didn't something click in your head and think, this isn't normal?
Yeah. Yes, I think by the time that happened, we had gotten a fight and I had already left once. You know, came back because I was feeling guilty. You know, he would say things like, we're married. You're not supposed to just leave a marriage so easily. Oh, you give up on your marriage. You took vows, right? So what these victims do is they absorb all that and they start to blame themselves.
Did you have anyone to confide in? I mean, did you have a sister, a mom, a best friend?
Yes, actually, my mom basically was like, I told you not to marry him. And you know what? Get away from him. Get away from him. My best friend would say, yeah, that's not right. I mean, what he's doing is not normal. It's not you. Because again, what happens with these victims is they start thinking, am I doing something wrong? Am I doing something to make him mad? And you just absorb all that because that's what they tell you all the time. I wouldn't have had to do this if you would have just done that. And you really start thinking that way. And you want to do everything that you can, you know. And it didn't help that at the time we went to the church pastor and he basically told me, do what you need to do to make things work. So here you are thinking, okay, I have to be better, right? I have to do things better.
But you had two daughters and eventually you got up the nerve to leave. What was the trigger? What made you say, I'm getting out?
Actually, we were only married for 3 years, and what the trigger was seeing him yell at my oldest daughter, who was only like 2 at the time. You know, shut up, and you know, she was under the table crying, and I thought, nope, Nope. Not doing that. No way.
So you were able to get out and you started to rebuild your life.
Yes. Yep. Started to rebuild. Actually went to a women's shelter for a while. And I had family, very, very good family. But I did not want him causing any issues with my family. I didn't want him showing up at my sister's, right? Or even my parents. I wanted to keep everybody safe. So we went to a shelter and we stayed there for a while. From there, I moved on to an apartment. And it was actually very humbling because I had been with him and he had everything in his name, the mortgage, the car. That's another thing that they do, the money, everything. So I had to have my mom co-sign for me. I'm like 34 years old, had to have her co-sign for me to get an apartment. And that apartment, we started out with a blanket, a pillow, and a lamp.
Oh my.
But you know what? It was great because it was just great being away from him. We just went on from there and built our life.
And you met a really nice guy.
Yeah, we did. I actually joined a choir, Bel Canto Choir from Milwaukee, and auditioned for that and made it. And I was very excited and met a nice guy, David Nikolai from choir, and started dating. And I told him I'm never getting married again. Not doing that again. So if that's what you're looking for, pal, forget it. You know, but here we are about 20 years later.
But the great thing is you did get married. It was a happy day. You had two beautiful daughters that participated in the wedding and you found out you were pregnant.
Yes. Yep, found out not too much longer after that I was. Actually, we found out January 30th, the night before all that happened. And I remember we went to the movies that night, and that's when the movie Elf was out. And that was the 30th. That was the day before.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
Next thing I knew, I was clobbered on the back of the head.
And that's where the horror began.
Yep.
Terry Jendusa Nikolai describes being attacked by her ex-husband and left to die in a garbage can filled with snow.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with Terry Jendusa Nikolai. The next morning you got up because the kids were with their father.
Yep. So got up like I always did. Went to pick them up at 10 o'clock at his house like I always did. Went there and it was very cold. I remember I left my car running with the heat on because usually I would just go up to the porch and grab them and go. And I rang the doorbell a couple of times. He wouldn't come. Went back to my car, sat in the car. It was cold out. Went back to the door. He finally answered. He's like, the kids are hiding. They want you to find them. They were like 4 and 6 at the time. That's what they did. So I kind of didn't think much of it and walked into his house and didn't see them anywhere. And I remember saying something like, oh, I wonder where they are. And from behind, you know, now that I think about it, in hindsight, I remember him going behind me to shut the front door. And next thing I knew, I was clobbered on the back of the head.
And that's where the horror began.
Yep. I was hit. And I learned from the deputies and from going to court several times, because I remember going to court and the defense attorney actually asking me, how many times were you hit on the head with a baseball bat? I said, I don't know, like 17. Well, the day you were found, you said 20. Are you lying? That's so ridiculous. And I'm like, okay, I didn't know I was supposed to stop and count. So I was taught by a deputy hit several times on the head with a baseball bat and lost consciousness in and out. He had then gagged me with some rags or something. He had taken off my socks and shoes and pants and duct taped my wrists and my ankles and my face. And then I, you know, just heard a bunch of noise, and he had a large Rubbermaid garbage cans in his living room and proceeded to put me in it. And even then, I was just amazed that I was still thinking. And even then, I was thinking to myself, I can't go in this can where I'm going to be upside down. And I moved myself around so I wasn't upside down when he put me in the can. I then heard the front door open and he had taken me outside in the can, and I just felt, you know, always going around and around. Well, he was filling up the can with snow. So I had no socks, no shoes, no pants.
And you could feel that cold.
Yeah. I think the high that day was 11 when he filled up the can with snow.
Was your face buried in the snow?
Well, my face was absolutely taped up, and I don't know how full the can was with snow. I just know that it was cold.
What were you thinking?
At that point, actually, I was thinking to myself, where are my girls? Where are they? Are they actually here? Is he doing this and they're here? Like, who's got them? Where are they? Did he do something to them? That's where my focus was. And I just kept thinking, I have to stay awake. I have to stay alive. I have to be here to help them.
The next thing that happened is he taped the top of that Rubbermaid garbage can and he put you in the back of his truck.
Yep, he put me in the back of the truck. I don't remember if the lid was taped at that point, because I do remember while he was driving, getting a glimpse because I pulled the tape down from one of my eyes and I could kind of see he had a tarp over the back of his truck over me. And I could see the tarp flapping in the wind. I could see that we were driving down a highway or something.
When all this was going on, did he say anything?
The only time he said anything was there was a point where I got one of my hands free because I used my thumbnail and I scratched off the tape. And I got one of my hands free and I was sticking it out of the garbage can to wave down passing traffic. And he had stopped. And, you know, one more stunt like that, I'll get out my 38. And I knew he had guns. He owned guns. I had actually, when I divorced him and got a restraining order, he was supposed to give his guns up. And he never did. And actually, that's one of the bills that I worked on that we got passed was getting abusers to have to give up their guns.
Going back to the point at which you were in the back of that truck, you heard sirens.
Yeah. So when he first put me in the back of the truck, I had always kept my phone in my pocket just because I never trusted him. You know, there were times when he would hit me or start yelling at me or whatever. So I had always had my phone in my pocket just in case. Never thought anything like that would happen. But and it was the old phone. So the numbers were raised so I could feel 911. So I had contacted 911. I think I found out later it was like three times. I remember contacting 911. I remember hearing sirens. I remember hearing the sirens passing us up. I remember thinking that I was dialing 911 right away again and come to find out it was like an hour later. I think it was Racine County. Then I think it was up Milwaukee County because he had taken my car and dropped it off in Milwaukee to make it look like I drove to Milwaukee and something happened to me. I don't know. And I think there was another call that came out. And then my then husband had called, or I called him or something, and he said, you know, save your phone battery. And that was the last.
So you were in the back of this truck, buried in snow, in a garbage can, and you were able to make these calls.
Yes. And I do remember there was one of the dispatchers, well, I think she got in trouble, but she was saying, who is this? And I was giving her my name. I was giving her his name, the address, saying, this guy's trying to kill me. This is the kind of truck he has. And she's like, how are you holding the phone?
She's questioning you.
Yeah, she was questioning me. It was very frustrating. And if you hear the recording from that, it's very frustrating to listen to.
But at this time, you know somebody knows you're there. You've called your husband. You've called the police. And you did hear those sirens. And you thought they were coming to rescue you.
Yep. And then you got to hear them just pass right up. So that was just...
What did you feel like when you when you realized they weren't going to stop the truck?
All hope was just crushed. But, you know, you don't give up in those circumstances. You don't. People watch scary movies and people scream or they give up or they're like, no, actually, there's a lot of not screaming. There's just a lot of silence. There's a lot of just thinking going on. What do I have to do next? What do I have to do to stay alive? How am I going to get out of this?
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
My head was swelling in the can. My feet were freezing. And I know I was blacking in and out.
Terry Jendusen-Nicolai describes what it was like being in a garbage can filled with snow for 26 hours and struggling to stay alive.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Terry Jendusen-Nicolai. At what point did the truck stop? And did you hear anything outside?
Yeah, so because I was blacking in and out, I just know that the truck had stopped and he had said, I'll get out my 38. Later, I found out after hearing about the interview that he had with the deputies after he was caught that he stopped at like a Wendy's or whatever, some fast food place, right? And they had asked him, oh, did you see her? No, I didn't see her all day. Oh, she's always late picking up the kids, which was an absolute lie. I couldn't wait to get my kids. Yeah, she's always late, so I had to get a babysitter. I just left without her. I never saw her. And then they said, well, deputies were at your house at this time. You know, I don't remember anything.
This was his interview, but I want to back up before
sure.
that, because he stopped at the Wendy's, you said, and got something to eat, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But did he pick up the kids then at some point, too?
He already had the kids. So finding out that the kids were in his house when he was beating me with a baseball bat.
The kids were actually in the house.
Yep. He had them locked in their bedroom.
And they didn't hear anything.
They told me that their TV was on really loud. So he turned on the TV real loud and just locked him in the room.
So when he took the garbage can and put it in the truck, he got the kids out. And put them in the truck as well?
Yes, in the cab with him.
So he's driving around with you in the back, the kids in the front, stops at the Wendy's, drove for, I'm sure at this point you don't know how long he's driving and behind the wheel, but it was a while.
Right, yes, because he went from Wind Lake to Milwaukee, dropped my car off, and then he drove down to where he worked in Illinois at an airport, about an hour or so away from Wind Lake.
All right, so he gets to someplace in Illinois. In Wheeling, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the truck stops, and this is when you heard your children's voices.
Yes. Yep. I heard their voices. Yep. And I just felt the can being moved. You know, he's taking me out of the truck. It was a storage locker unit that he had rented and wheeled me in there. And I just remember hearing a bunch of things being shuffled around.
But you heard the children.
I heard the kids.
Did you think to say something, to cry out to them?
You know, I didn't, because in my mind, I was afraid that if they would do something or try to help me or say something, he would do something to them. That's what I was thinking. So at that point, I didn't say anything.
But what was it like hearing their voices?
I know, it was horrible.
Was there relief, though, that at least you knew they were okay?
Yes and no. Knowing that they were with him was not a relief. He's a horrible person. I had no idea what he was going to do.
So now you felt this movement. You heard the voices. What happened next?
So I heard a bunch of scooting and moving things around, and he had left me in that storage unit. He had left me in there. I heard a door shut. I heard that. And I waited for a while because, again, I'm thinking if he's still around, I don't want to call out for help because then he's going to know, maybe he thinks I'm dead, and then he'll know that I'm not dead, and then maybe he will just shoot me or something. So I waited for a while, and then when I didn't hear anything for a while, I started yelling for help.
You're still inside that container.
Still in the container.
And the snow is still there.
Yep.
You're bleeding.
Yes.
The pain had to be excruciating.
Yes. And actually, with bare feet, I remember my feet were just so cold, and I was trying to get my hands there to cup my feet. But I could, you know, I'm 5'7". There's no way I couldn't get my hands to where my feet were, no matter what I tried to do. And then it was weird, too, because I remember after a certain amount of time, I felt like the can was being compressed, the can that I was in. But then later on, realizing when I was in the hospital, my head was just swelling. So my head was, the doctors told me, was so swollen. Didn't even look like a human being. So my head was swelling in the can. My feet were freezing, and I know I was blacking in and out.
Were you still trying to get loose?
Oh, yes. Still trying to get out. I remember punching the lid of the garbage can, you know, trying to punch a hole through it, trying to feel, you know what, I got a little tiny bit open where my hand was going in and out, but it was being scraped. It was frozen, and it was being scraped up, going in and out, but just trying to feel. And he had like 2x4s and other stuff on top of it. He just really had me in there.
You said you started to go in and out of consciousness.
Yes.
How did you stay awake?
Praying, just trying to keep myself awake, just praying that my girls were okay, praying to get me out of there, just really trying to keep myself going.
Did you lose all track of time?
Yes. I knew that it felt like forever, knowing the timeline now. I think he got to that storage locker maybe like 3 p.m, and then they found me like, I think it was like 1 o'clock the next day. So it was almost 24 hours.
And before that, it had been, what, 5 hours of just horror?
Yep, because I got to his house at 10 a.m.
Did you think you were going to die?
Yeah. And it's weird because at that point, I thought, I die. I'm not a perfect person, but I'm a believer and I know I'll be okay. But I was so concerned about my kids. So concerned about my kids. And that's what made me keep fighting. I couldn't imagine. Number one, I didn't know what he was going to do to them, or even just the thought of them growing up with him.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I heard someone there and my first thought was, oh, is it him? So I was quiet at first because I didn't want him to know that I was still alive.
Terry Jendusa Nicolai talks about hearing a voice after 26 hours and not knowing if it was somebody coming to kill her or to save her.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Terry Jendusa Nicolai. Here you are in the dark, excruciating pain, trying to stay awake. thinking he's going to come back.
Yeah, I thought, and actually when help did arrive, I heard someone there, and my first thought was, oh, is it him? So I was quiet at first because I didn't want him to know that I was still alive. And I waited until I heard somebody say, we're rescue or we're the sheriff's department. Then I started yelling more because when I heard somebody, you know, bang on the door or whatever, I didn't know who it was and I didn't want to say anything yet.
You must have been amazed that after all this time, somebody was there to actually rescue
you.
Yeah.
When I heard that it was rescue, I was so relieved. All I remember was somebody saying, stay with me. I don't even really remember being taken out of the garbage can. I don't remember being put in a truck. I don't remember any of that. I just remember somebody just holding my hand going, stay with me. And then somebody said, what's your name? And I said, Terry from Racine. And that's all I remember. I don't remember ambulance ride, nothing until I woke up in the hospital.
So now there's this parallel story going on where because of your 911 calls and because you were able to talk to your husband and tell him that he had you or that something had happened, the police were on the hunt for your ex.
Yes, they were. And this was pretty amazing, actually. They were looking for him and then they had found out where he worked and gone to his work. Apprehended him. And when they had his wallet and all of his stuff and they were questioning him. And again, at first, I didn't see her all day. I have no idea. She always does this. She never comes to pick up the kids. And then they said, you know, what time did you finally leave your house after waiting for her? Oh, I don't know, like 11:30. Well, that's kind of funny. We were at your house at 11:10. You weren't there. There was blood on the floor. And then he realizes that he's in trouble. So then he changes the story to, oh yeah, I was just at home and says that he didn't expect me at all, even though I'm supposed to pick up the girls 10 o'clock on Saturday. It's not a surprise. I didn't expect her at all. And all of a sudden I looked and she's in my house and she's standing over me with a hammer. What? And I think that he thought, because he knew that he had taken my pants and all that, so he's trying to incorporate that in a story. So he said, I was standing over him with my pants down. Yeah, because that's how we go after people, right? We take our pants down and go, hey, I'm going to get you. It's just so ridiculous. So then they got him to say that, but then he wouldn't tell him where I was. And I just remember talking to these detectives later. They were so frustrated. Like, we know she's out there somewhere. The elements are horrible. Where is she? I don't know. I can't remember. But they said, you must be hungry. Can we get... No, I stopped at Wendy's. Oh, what did you have? Double cheeseburger, curly fries. He remembers all that. But he didn't remember what he did to his ex-wife. So for hours and hours. And what happened was one of their absolutely phenomenal investigators had been looking through his wallet and realized that, why does this guy have a storage locker in Illinois if he lives in Wisconsin? This is kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you do that? So they called the storage locker place. They said, was this guy here today? Yep, he was here at, you know, whatever, 3 o'clock or whatever it was. Can you go to his storage locker and see if he can see anything or hear anything? So the guy went and he heard me yelling inside.
And that's how the police found you. What was the proximity to that storage locker to where he worked?
Very close. So when he sat in the tower, he could see.
As an air traffic controller.
Yep, he could see the storage.
He could actually look down.
Yep, that's what I was told. Yep. And what I found out later is that in the storage locker were other things like wedding photos, my wedding dress.
He kept all that.
Creepy, weird stuff. Yeah.
I know you didn't have an easy recovery. When did they arrest him, by the way? When did they put the handcuffs on him and put him behind bars?
That day when they apprehended him at his job before he even admitted to anything.
So now they've got him.
Now they got him. Yep. And then he had dropped the girls off at a girlfriend's house or something. So they went and got the girls. And my sister took the girls. And, you know, when I woke up in the hospital, that was my question. Where are my girls? When they told me my sister had them, I didn't care about anything else. Didn't care about anything else.
But you still had a long recovery.
Yes.
What were the injuries that you had at that time?
So, well, number one, I believe my body temp was like 86 degrees, something like that. They were afraid of my body shutting down, basically, because of my core temperature. I had extensive frostbite on my feet, my legs, my hands, my arms. I do remember where they had lines drawn on my arms and legs where they thought that they would have to amputate because of extensive frostbite. I had a large gaping hole in the back of my head from being beat with a baseball bat. Again, my head was swollen and I lost the baby that I was carrying. So I had all these injuries. I remember my dad being in the hospital with me and he said, "Where doesn't it hurt?" I said, "The inside of my earlobe." That was probably the only place that didn't hurt at that time. My entire body was bruised all over.
How long was it before you were able to see your girls?
Well, I was in ICU, but even in ICU after I came to, after the first couple of days, they usually don't allow it, but I pleaded and they allowed me to call them from ICU. And at that point too, I was afraid. I didn't want to say mom's in the hospital because I was beat to death. So I said something like I had to go someplace for work or something because I didn't know what to.
Because they were little.
Yeah. And I didn't want to scare them, you know, and I said, "Oh, everything's okay. I'll see you soon." And then I think it was subsequent conversations where I said, "Well, something happened. I'm in the hospital, but I'll be okay, but I'll be okay." Mm-hmm. And I do remember when my husband brought them and we had a child psychologist come with and ease them into because they were shocked when they saw me and didn't look good at all. And, you know, if we just reassured them I was going to be okay, we were going to be okay. And I remember the therapist saying, "Well, you know who did this to them? Your dad." And I just remember the looks on their faces was kind of like, yeah. They weren't surprised. I mean, they knew he was an
animal. What was your heart like, though, the first time you set your eyes on them?
Yeah. I mean, that's all I cared about. That's all I cared about was to know that they were safe and they were okay. It really was hard, though, because I was in the hospital for almost 2 months. It was really hard for me to be away from them for that long. Very hard for me. You know, my husband, my sister, people would bring them to visit. We would try to make the visits fun. You know, they thought it was cool to push the button and the nurse would come and give them ice cream, stuff like that. So we would try to keep everything. Hey, he's gone. He can't hurt us. He can't do anything. I'm going to be better. Everything's going to be okay.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
He had a defense attorney that was victim blaming. "Didn't you leave a message at his phone that was kind of snarky?" Okay, so that gives somebody permission to beat someone over the head with a baseball bat?
The act Terry Jendusa Nicolai talks about what happened in the courtroom when her husband was tried for attempted murder.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with Terry Jendusa Nicolai. I'm your host, Libby Collins. You've recovered.
Yes.
And now it's time to bring your ex-husband to justice.
Mm-hmm.
You must have thought, "Oh, this is easy. He's going away forever." But it didn't quite work out that way.
No. So he was charged state and federally. So they tried to say, "Oh, it's double jeopardy." And so I did have a defense attorney and said, "Oh my gosh, we have over 100 pieces of physical evidence. A monkey could do this trial." But, you know,
the prosecutor, you mean?
I mean the prosecutor. Yeah. Okay. But he still had a defense attorney that tried to, it was the victim blaming, right?
They went after you.
Yeah. "Didn't you on whatever, October, whatever, you know, 2000, leave a message at his phone that was kind of snarky?" And I'm like, okay, so that gives somebody permission to beat someone over the head with a baseball bat?
They actually put you in a chair in front of a judge and went after you.
Yeah. And you should. My dad was sitting out. my dad had to almost be held back by, you know, and I remember going in the side room with the prosecutor during a break. And my dad's just like, give me five minutes in this room with him. You know, "No, Mr. Jendusa, we can't, you know."
With the defense attorney. You're not,
or with my ex.
With your ex-husband. Okay.
He goes, I'll save you all a lot of money.
But you had to sit there and look at him.
Mm-hmm.
Looking him in the eye. What was his demeanor to you when you got up there and you said, "Now's my chance. I'm going to tell my story"?
He just kind of glared at me. But you know what, though? At that point, I had such great support from the victim's advocate, the victim witness, and the prosecutive team and my friends and family that when I got to that point, I really thought, "Oh, my God, I'm going to have to see him." But you know what? When I got to that point, I just looked at him and I thought, you know what? You're the one in the orange jumpsuit. You're the one with the handcuffs and the ankle chains. You're the one who did wrong. And you can't hurt me anymore. It was almost this feeling of like, I'm really not afraid of you anymore. But it was frustrating. I still remember the defense attorney saying, "And didn't you drag him through family court?" Like he was such a victim.
During the divorce.
Yeah. I'm like, well, and even after the divorce, because he wasn't abiding by the rules that he was supposed to do. He wasn't paying child support. He wasn't doing the custody arrangement. He just purposely never did what he was supposed to do. So, of course, I had to go back to court to get things. It was just horrible in our life.
But How long did this last? How long were you on the stand, on the witness stand?
I couldn't tell you. Right now, it's been quite some time.
I mean, was it more than one day?
I don't even remember.
Okay.
I believe, for in Racine County and then in Milwaukee for the federal.
So you were testifying a lot. Was this in front of a jury?
No, actually, they wanted a judge, just the judge trial. And I'll never forget the judge in Racine County, Dennis Berry, who has since passed away. But I remember he listened to everything. I remember the defense attorney trying to say he was a Boy Scout and all this other stuff. And that judge saying, I've taken all this into account, and you're saying that you have amnesia and you don't remember what happened. And I say that's baloney. I remember the Racine Journal Times had a picture with Judge Berry on the front page, and he was saying, baloney.
All right. So what was the verdict in that one trial, the first one, the state trial?
Yeah, he was definitely guilty. And I believe it was, you know, attempted homicide and interference with custody. And then in the federal, it was the federal kidnapping. And then I believe it may have been another, I don't know if it was an actual charge, but, you know, something that they added on for the death of the unborn child as well. And they tried to muddy the waters with that, too. Well, didn't you have a miscarriage, like, you know, 8 years ago? Like, and what does it have to do with this?
So what was the final adjudication on this? What did they sentence him to?
Basically life. He had like 38 years, I believe, in state, and then like life in federal. It won't be.
There's no parole.
No parole.
So he's out. He's gone.
He's gone. And actually, he went to Waupun. And during his time at Waupun, let's see, it would have been 4 or 5 years after that, we had found out through the Racine County Sheriff that he was plotting some type of escape with his dad. And they found out about this. And they came to my home and told us. And we took everything and left. Went on the lam for a while. I literally felt like I was in a movie. That he was trying to pay someone to finish me off. So because of that, he was sent to Boscobel for a while.
Do either of your daughters have any contact with him whatsoever?
No. Nope.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I thought, you know what? I need to take this opportunity to let those people know that there is another side. You can get away from this.
Terry Jendusen Nicolai talks about her life today, how she's become an advocate for those who need help, and also whether or not her life story might be made into a movie.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Terry Jendusen Nicolai. Oh, what about you? Terry, you've been through hell and back, and you've survived, and you've done it with a sense of humor. That's what I really admire about you. But you've also decided, I'm not alone, and there are other people who have gone through similar situations.
Yes.
And you have made it your mission in life to do whatever you can to help them.
Yes. I remember when I woke up in the hospital and I was like, oh my gosh, I have to call work and tell them I'm not coming. And my husband's like, I think they know. I'm like, how do they know? You're all over the news. I'm like, I am. And I thought, you know what? I need to take this opportunity to let those people know that there is another side. You can get away from this. There are people out there to help you. Don't feel like you're stuck in a situation like that. Because that's how I felt for a while. You feel stuck, especially because people like that, they'll control everything, right? The money, that how, you know, everything. And you are told by them and you start believing that you're nothing without them. So I wanted people to know that you are not alone and other people have gone through the worst of it and come out on the other side so you can too.
And you've even gotten involved in public service. I mean, you, on a very small scale, got involved in your own community and said, hey, I'm going to do things.
Yeah, the reason I started that, you know, I was going around the nation and giving talks to high school kids, college kids, how to stay out of bad situations like this, how to get out of a bad situation. I wanted to give back. And actually, at that time, I didn't even realize that we got paid for being on town board. I just thought I was just going to volunteer and do some service for the town. So 9 years ago, I decided my kids were big enough and in school that I could take some time and volunteer some time. And I got elected to the town board as a supervisor 2016 and started doing some supervisor work there. And I just really liked it. I loved working with the people. And 2 years ago, I ran for chair and I was elected and things were going really great. I had put a lot of things in place that made a lot of people happy. I opened meetings up for public comment. I held daily office hours for people to come talk to me, and they did. We had a lot of people coming in with like neighbor disputes and things, and I would sit them both down and work things out. And it was just a really good feeling that I was doing good things for neighbors and for the town. And then all hell broke loose about a year ago when we had to do some cleaning up with our PD.
And it was because you really saw people who were being abused and you didn't want to stand for it.
Exactly. So I had a female officer come to me and say, hey, I've had this issue for like 3 or 4 years now, and nobody's helped me. I'm like, what? How can nobody help you? You know, she's like, I went to the chief. He's stonewalling me. I went to at that time, and I have a lot of respect for a previous chair, but there was kind of a culture there. Okay. The other little good old boys culture. And the person who is the chair now, who won the election instead of me, he was part of that as well. As a matter of fact, he was the police liaison. So he should have been overlooking the stuff that was going on at the PD. And, you know, there's two things. Either he just wasn't doing his job, or he knew what was going on and he looked the other way. So that's what was happening. So she wasn't getting anywhere. She had a complaint against a lieutenant who was her supervisor. That complaint supposedly went to Big Bend to be investigated. She was asking and asking and asking for years, whatever happened with that, what's going on, and was stonewalled everywhere she turned. So I started looking into it. Nobody should be treated like that. She's a good officer. She also works for the Racine County Sheriff's Department. She's a good deputy. I started asking questions, and I started being stonewalled. So I talked to the chief, and I don't have a report for that. Well, if you had an investigation, there's got to be some kind of report. There's got to be some kind of, and I was getting the same runaround. So I talked to the lieutenant who was involved, getting the runaround from him. So then I went to Big Bend. Where is this report? So that's kind of where things started. It wasn't long after that when she filed an actual complaint and said, I'm filing a complaint. I had this and this and this happen. Please do something about it. She went to her union, and I received an email from her union as well stating, we're going to go to the EEOC. We're going to lawyer up. So naturally, I did my job as the chair of the town. I took all that information to my board. We had an attorney come, and we all decided that we need to investigate this. There wasn't any other way.
What happened?
So about 12 days after I received all that from her, I received another email from a different police officer complaining about one of the other lieutenants. And that had allegations of sexual harassment, retaliation, you know, time card, that just all this stuff, and brought that to the board. So the board unanimously, this is what we need to do. We need to investigate. Now, investigations aren't started to find fault. Investigations are to find truth. So us as the board did what we needed to do. There's these things that came forward. People are asking for investigations. They seem to warrant investigations, not saying that, oh, yep, all that stuff must be true, but it has to be looked into, especially sexual harassment and things like that. You can't just let that stuff go. If they investigate it and say, nope, there's nothing to this, great. So I had to, as chair, which I actually at the time, I was teary-eyed. It was really hard for me. I had to take those two lieutenants and put them on leave. They went on paid leave, and I had good relationships with everyone. I, as chair, actually, one Friday every month made family Fridays where I brought in food for the officers and for everybody, and we all had lunch together. I mean, that's the kind of person I am. I got along with everyone. So it was really hard for me to do that because I wasn't really sure what was going on, if they did these things or they didn't do these things. It was hard. And I remember when they had to give me their belt and their badge, they left, and I was in tears. It was just weird to have to do that. I did not like doing that. So they were put on leave and their investigations started. And we used a outside entity because a lot of times when officers are investigated, you'll just use Racine County Sheriff or another. But we purposely did it because there's so many people that know people. Mm-hmm. And we didn't want anybody who didn't like them or whatever. We just didn't want any biases.
Any preconceived ideas.
Exactly.
So who did you use?
SCSS Services. That was somebody that our attorney recommended that he had worked with before. Community Security Systems. And they were good reputable company. We checked into it. So we decided to go with them. Somebody totally outside. These people who work there, the investigators, they were police officers themselves. So they understand. So we thought that we were just really doing a really good investigation with non-biased people. The investigation took some time. Actually, we had three going at the same time because right before we put those two on leave, one of those lieutenants had put someone else on leave for something else. So we had three going during that time. As you know, you can't say anything. Right. You can't say what it's about, what's going on, because that those are just the rules. And it was really hard because we had a lot of really good people that were like, hey, I'd like to know what the heck's going on, but I understand. OK. But then we had the crowd that was like, I demand to know. Well, I'm sorry. I'm not going to put the town at risk by telling you things I'm not supposed to tell you right now. I will give you the appropriate information at the appropriate time. And everything that I put out there on social media or that I said was always looked over by the attorney to make sure everything, you know, I just wanted to make sure I was doing the right thing. I didn't want to make the town liable for anything. I've never been through anything like this before, wanted to do the right thing, but we had a pretty nasty group of people in Waterford that just thought that they were privy to all the details. And because
now you're talking about people who were just in the community.
Residents.
Okay.
Yep. And because we couldn't give them the details, well, then, of course, they start creating their own narratives. Oh, Terry's just trying to get rid of the police department. They didn't do anything. She just wants to get rid of the PD. And there's just so much. There was just so much going on. It was really a hard year because not only did you have all the stuff that was actually going on in the PD, then you had this certain group of people that was all over social media, all over everywhere else, just saying all this bad stuff about you. And you're sitting there going, I'm a nice person. I don't understand why they would do this.
What did they finally find with the investigation?
Well, we were finally able to tell people because one of the lieutenants had an injunction, so we couldn't release his records. That was finally dismissed. So after all this time, we were finally able to put out the information and they can read all the transcripts and all the police officers saying, yep, this happened, this happened. So you would think that since that's out there, they would say, oh. Well, most people read it and said, oh, that was going on. Okay, I get it now. They've really had a hard job to do. They were cleaning out the PD. There's still a small group of people out there that are like, oh, I don't think these investigations were warranted. Big deal. It's like, oh, dear Lord.
But in the meantime, you ran for re-election.
Yes.
What happened?
I did not make it because of this huge pro-Waterford PD social media. And, you know, Terry's just, and you know what? I have to say, yes, it wasn't just those three. So as those three were being investigated, our chief had just retired. We had two lieutenants gone. So there was nobody at the top. Things were too messy to pull somebody from within that department and put him in charge. It wouldn't have worked. So I contacted Racine County Sheriff. Can you help us? We need somebody to stabilize this department right there. I would do that a million times again. They were a class act. They sent their lieutenant, who basically did the job of our previous chief and two lieutenants, okay, got everything whipped in shape, did everything by the book. So while he was there, we were finding, let me just say, we were finding a culture of doing what you want, not necessarily following the rules. We found out that none of our officers had any field training. Now, they were trained because a lot of them came from different departments, okay? So, yes, they know how to be a police officer. But just like maybe I'm a bank teller at Associated Bank, that doesn't mean I can go to BMO and know exactly what to do the first day because everything's different. So every department has their own field training. We came to find out that none of our officers went through that field training. There was just all the stuff that we were finding, all the misbehavior on officers' part.
Misbehavior meaning?
Well, I'll give you just a couple. At the end of July, we had a missing elderly lady with dementia. Super, super hot. If you remember the end of July, it was really hot outside. She had been missing for quite some time. And we had an officer who was, you know, we had the Racine County Sheriff, we had the Tishkin Fire, we had so many people outside entities helping us in the search. We had one of our officers who just decided he was going to leave and go home because he's done.
Well, she's out there somewhere and mm-hmm. they can't find her.
So the person in charge is like, where are you going? I'm done. I'm leaving. You can't just leave. You know how things like this work. I mean, unless there's like an emergency or something, right? All hands on deck. You can't just do this. You know, I can see how this is being run. F this, blah, 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 blah. And decides to walk off. So, of course, he gets reprimanded. Well, how dare somebody reprimand me? I quit. Okay? So we had so much stuff like that going on, which made us realize and uncover that there was just this culture of, I don't have to do things the right way. I don't have to follow policy. And now that somebody's telling me to, I'm not going to put up with that.
And by the way, did they find the lady?
Yes, they did. Thank God.
Okay.
Yes.
So at what point then did you decide to run for re-election?
Actually, a few months before that, I wasn't quite sure if I wanted to stay in this because we had all this stuff going on. Like I said, misbehavior, all this stuff that we're finding out in the PD. It was like you'd walk in the office and it's like, guess what, so-and-so. I mean, I felt like I was on a reality TV show. Like, are you kidding me? Not what now? That's what it felt like. But then in the meantime, it was made extra bad because of this little group of people, right, in Waterford who just thought that they knew what was going on, and they just thought all this was, what do they say, a nothing burger. Oh, you're doing all these, it's going to be a nothing burger, and you're spending all this money on investigations. And so let me tell you, after a while, I saw how well the Racine County Sheriff's Department did their job. They were professional. They did things by the book. They had a presence. They were there. So as a leader, I'm naturally thinking, we have a mess here in our PD. We have a department here who's terrific. Guess what? I'm going to ask for a proposal. We don't have to have our own PD in our town. We're not bound by any statute to have our own PD. So I asked for a proposal. Half price. So instead of the $1.4 million that the town of Waterford usually spends on policing, we would have spent $623,000. And that would have given us all the radios that we needed, body cameras that we didn't have. It was a no-brainer. So I started giving this information to people, and then the story started that I just purposely took the PD down because I wanted the sheriff's department to come in. It was just ridiculous. So there were times when I'm like, this is such a headache. I don't need this in my life. The pay is not good. I did the math. I was making like $5 an hour. Why am I doing this to myself? My partner, Supervisor Ulander, who's still on the board, he and I were putting up with the bulk of this because he was the police liaison at the time, and I was the chair, so it was mostly us and our poor clerks putting up with the bulk of this. Both of us would be on the phone with each other and I going, why are we doing this? Why? And we'd have to talk each other from the ledge and say, okay, we just have to keep going because we're doing the right thing. We have to clean everything up. We have to make things right for everyone. So I decided to run again because I just wanted to finish the job and get things on the right track. But there was that group out there that was loud with their misinformation, and I think that's what happened.
So where does the town of Waterford Police Department stand today?
So right now, actually, we did have a legal vote in January to go with the sheriff's department. So they haven't even voted really yet to undo that or to stay with the PD. So I know that the new chair, who was the old police liaison where a lot of this trouble came from, is working toward rebuilding the PD. All I can say is good luck. I know that we have just a few officers left. There's no training. There's no training program. There's body cameras that are going to be purchased. There's radios that have to be purchased. There's just, it's not my problem anymore.
So, Terry, you have been involved in a controversy with the mayor of Franklin.
Yes.
How does this all tie in together?
So the mayor of Franklin was one of the lieutenants that I had to put on leave. And I can tell you, I mean, before all that happened, you know, we were friendly, we got along. But since he had a town hall where he was telling everybody that everything that was found in the investigation is baloney, right? None of it.
Were you behind bringing that out to the public? I mean, before the town hall happened, how did that all come to light?
It came about because there were people who requested open records. That wasn't me. And then those open records were released and then whatever.
That was within the town of Franklin?
Within the town of Waterford, the open records.
Okay.
So when the open records came out, and people saw that, you know, I'm guessing that people in Franklin saw that. So that's all tied in, right? So he had a town hall.
Did you ask for those open records?
No, I did not. Okay. Nope. There were other people who did, and they released them and did what they did. They're out there.
Okay.
I believe Dan O'Donnell talked about it, too. So it's out there. And I'm not here to say he's guilty, he's not guilty. You know, people have said, what are your – all I'm going to tell people is read the transcripts, make up your own mind. But he did have a town hall. He was trying to address all the issues and people's questions. But during that town hall, and I was there in the back with a group of my friends, he said, and I was friends with the chair, and I would have never done this to her. And then he says, you know, I know she suffers from PTSD because of what happened to her. Now, let me just say, I remarkably don't have PTSD. After everything that I've been through, I did go to counseling, obviously, after that. They never diagnosed me with PTSD, ever. I don't know. It's just, I don't know, I'm lucky. But let's just say, even people who do have PTSD, that doesn't make them a bad person, you know. But he was just using that as kind of like, she has PTSD, you know, i.e., she's crazy, right? I don't know why she put me on, you know. So it was very manipulative the way he was doing it. I was friends with her, and I understand she suffers from PTSD from the horrible stuff that she went through, but I don't think she thinks straight. You know, we should have never had these investigations. But no, I'm here to tell you, I think very straight. I did a really hard job. There were many times when I just thought to myself, you know what? I'm just going to stop doing the right thing because it's really hard, you know?
So where do you go from here? I mean, you've been an advocate. This horrible, horrible, horrible crime took place over 20 years ago. Since then, as you said, you've talked to young people. You've Yes. talked to other women. You've talked to men. You've talked to anybody who wants to get a message out that you can survive abuse.
Yes.
What are you going to do now?
I've actually.
I mean, your kids are grown.
Yep.
Your two daughters are in their 20s.
Yep.
You've got a son who's about to graduate from high school.
Yep.
What's life for you at this point?
I have many opportunities knocking at the door. I do have the same type of going back to the advocacy work, going help, you know, with legal advocacy, with doing talks. I do have a producer who was interested in making a film. So there's a lot of really cool things. And besides that, even better than that, there's going to be two more grandkids coming up. So that's even better than all that combined.
You mentioned a film. Now, up to this point, all of the things that have been on television, movies, whatever, have been documentaries. Are you talking about a film that would be...
Yes.
Based on your story.
Yes. I was approached by someone to actually make a movie, and he had asked me to, you know, put basically in writing what I can put in writing, and it's just been so busy, I haven't done that yet. And, you know, I was upset that I didn't win my election in a way, because I just wanted to put the town on the right track. But personally, for me, it's... Okay, you know, I can breathe for a while. I can spend time doing things that I want to do.
Terry, who would play you in that movie?
I don't know, but I love Sandra Bullock. I don't know. I'm not quite sure. That'll be interesting to see.
And what's the rest of your story like?
I just hope that it's a lot of family, and just continuing to help people wherever God puts me.
Terry Jindusa Nicolai, you are an amazing lady.
Oh, thank you.
We've been talking with Terry Jindusa Nicolai, who I admire so much. She's a survivor. And not only has she survived a terrible attack, but also she's turned her life into something that's helping others, helping other people who have been abused by their partners, and also being an advocate in community affairs. Now, if you joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Terry, you can go to WTMJ.com, and that's where you're going to find more of what we talked about on a podcast that features a lot of things that she has been going through lately. So check that out. And you'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.